Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we're going to talk about why the heck we built an Earthship and moved to the middle of nowhere, or
what the heck were we thinking?
Yeah, okay, all right. So this is a very personal one here for you, about our motivation. Well, for you, certainly. So let's go back.
Travel back in time.
Yes, to the very beginning. Why the heck did you think, and I'm going to put this on you, why did you think it was a good idea to build a house out of tires in the middle of the beautiful foothills of the Appalachian Mountains?
I don't think I quite thought about it like that. What I was worried about as I got into my 30s was that someday I was going to be old, and then that meant I was going to be crippled and fat, to put it bluntly. And
that's such a pleasant view of being an elderly
citizen. No, I'm saying about myself. I'm not talking about other people. If the shoe fits, wear it, as my grandma would say. But I just was very concerned about quality of life, and this was even long before I was thinking about building houses out of garbage and so forth. And so my answer, through lack of knowledge, was I would say to you, now when we get older, we've got to buy a farm, and then we'll live on the farm, and then I won't turn out being like the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, always all frozen up and not able to move. And so when our granddaughter was going to be born, we decided that we would start looking for some property so that we could buy something that was nearby where she was going to be, so we didn't have to be absentee grandparents, and then it would become our summer retreat for our family, and that was that. But then Catelyn was born. It was a big change in our lives, and we became the parents.
It was a big change in her life as well.
Well, yeah, and so a lot of changes for us. And so the week that she was born, we bought 38.2 acres in Muskingum County, a very hilly 38.2 acres. And then that was the beginning of trying to figure out what to do. And I did say to you, which heaven knows where that came from, but I would say to you, oh, we have to build a house that has some economic input into this community, because it's a sin to live in a country where a lot of people don't have one house, and we're going to have two. So when Catelyn was about 6 months old, she was laying on my belly, and I was listening to WMNF radio, community radio station in Tampa, Florida, and I heard the architect, Michael Reynolds, talking about building houses out of clean trash. And Catelyn was on my belly, and I looked at her, and I said, you and Mama are gonna do that. And I'm sure she shook her head yes, even though she was sound asleep, because that became my dream. And I have no idea why I thought that, or why I thought I could do that. And that's how it all got started, Jay.
Is it?
Yes, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're really, really big on planning. And I think what this kind of points out is you say, all right, we have some vague plan. And the plan is that as we age, we need to come up with lifestyle choices that require movement. So that's sort of the first stage of what this plan was all about. We need, and you decided, okay, a farm where there are
this
animals.
This is so cute.
I know. I'm going to reconstruct our history.
Your marketing.
Where you are responsible for all these decisions. So you say, all right, you want animals.
I was responsible, but I was a good salesperson, and you were easily sold.
I'm a manipulated buyer.
So
the animals don't really care if you don't feel like getting up and feeding them, or you don't feel like milking the goats, whatever.
Yeah, they do.
They require you to be there. And so your body is going to be moving whether you want it to or not. So that was kind of that motivation. Well, then another opportunity presents itself when your mind is already predisposed to this is going to be on our agenda for some point. Then comes along the idea of a tire house. Now, that's way out left field, but there it was. So we say, all right, now we've got this property. We've got this idea of someday living on a farm, so why not build it out of tires?
Well, because I think, too, I just kept feeling like if we did that, it was going to make a difference. We were going to use the resources we had, whatever those were, to actually make a difference for somebody besides you and me. And that seemed really valuable. And I think we did that a lot in our relationship. We've always had people living with us at different times because they had problems or there was some emergency or whatever. And in the end of the day, it was always a rich experience. So it just made sense to kind of use that as our guide. And then, of course, I had to sell it to you, Mr. I don't know those people. Why are they in my house kind of guy?
Which seems a reasonable question. So, well, and once again, this was your motivation, obviously, was very altruistic. Mine was more
cheap.
Well,
you wanted to be cheap.
I wasn't going to say cheap. I was going to say unthinking, oblivious, just sort of moving along. It was a vague impression of this will be interesting. And that's about as far as I got with it.
I know when I was building the house, like when we had an open house or something, and you would show up looking so handsome in your suit coming from the airport, so you'd been somewhere, and people would start asking you about the house and the construction and everything right off, and you'd be like, I don't know anything about this. I've never even pounded a tire. You need to talk to Annie. And of course, they didn't want to talk to me. I was a woman. I couldn't possibly be doing such crazy stuff. And they just keep chatting at you the whole time.
I guess of the two of us, I was the crazy looking one. So.
In your suit standing in a house of mud, I guess.
It's always
maybe.
Good to wear a suit when you're pounding tires. So.
Yeah.
But and in my own defense,
I've come
to accept this. And now it feels weird to have been traveling on an airplane in a suit in the first place. I'm going to give up that lifestyle. And I guess, you know, once again, you've proven right on this, that it was the right decision. But what was it like? I mean, we've hinted at it that in the very first days of doing this, you were the primary mover of this. I mean, I was still working and trying to earn a living. And
I was working and I had a baby.
Come on,
and
that was just play.
So. Oh, yeah. I was I was running a women's fund.
There
oh,
you go.
Yeah.
So you were up here in the summertime. Lounging about,
I guess, getting a suntan.
Tires.
Yeah.
And so what was that like?
Well, when we first got started and we're trying to think about what we would do, I met up with you in Taos, New Mexico, where the architect was, so that we could look at some houses that were already finished and also look at some of the techniques that were involved in creating the building. And that was eye-opening. And I think at that moment, you were really glad that you had told me several years before, Annie, if you need any work done around the house, hire somebody. And said, thank
In other
you.
Words, don't look at me.
No, don't ask me to do
I'm wearing a suit and I'm going on an airplane, all right? Let me know
right.
when it's over.
Yeah, that's right. So I was pretty independent, but I really was committed to this building. And so I came here. I would come here at different times to the property and I would plant fruit trees and I tried to create a little bit of a hut that I could stay in so I could have some place out of the elements with the baby, which was a pretty good idea. And then when I started asking contractors to come and talk to us, and I only did this when you were going to be there because I was worried about being by myself. And we had also made a compass on the spot where we wanted to have the house to see how the trees were going to impact the site because everybody kept telling us I was going to have to cut down the trees. And so we built the compass so we could look at how the trees were impacting everything each season of the year. And we had, I think, three different contractors who were recommended by people who came to sit down and look at the house plans with us that the architect had given. Well, not given, had sold to us. And then you would walk with the person up to the site. And what would the person say to you?
Is she nuts?
Yeah, and what did you say?
Yes.
No, you did not.
Clearly, she's insane.
You did not.
No one comes here and builds a house out of tires. Let's you and me, Mr. Contractor, get out of here. No, that's not what we said. But yeah, it was always funny because they always assumed I was the one in charge, and it turned out we simply could not get a contractor to do it. It was too outside their comfort level.
Right. Even though we were going to pay them to go and study with the architect and everything, they didn't want to do it. So what did you say to me?
I said, well, Annie, I guess you're the contractor. I'm out of here.
And then I started to cry because I never built anything in my life except to take some sheets my grandma gave me and clothespin them over the swing set so I could make a teepee and hide from my mother.
And that's how we built the airship, with
clothespin. That's pretty much it. No, well, and that same kind of fortitude, I would say.
Well, what we found, though, and this is a shame to say, but almost all of the progress that we made on the airship, we simply had to just do ourselves.
Right.
And learn how to do it, make our mistakes, keep pressing forward, and you know, through determination and sweat and hard work and that resilience that made this country great, we built a house out of tires.
Yes, we did. And I think, too, we had a vision. I certainly had a vision of what it would be like and how it would work. And so I was always working towards that. And there were lots of issues. You know, the work ethic of the people that were hired was often really tough. Being by myself with a little kid. One time there was the most horrible storm and there was a flash flood. And, I'm not scared of storms, but I had a little kid and I just would be a little worried about being under these huge oak trees in a shed, you know.
Well, when you're talking about the work ethic, it always cracked me up because I would come here and some of the people tried to hire some local labor, especially during the tire pounding stage. And some of these guys would show up and work for maybe an hour. And then you just see the sledgehammer lying there and they'd be gone. But then they come back the next Friday to want to be paid for the hour that they worked, which was,
Well, I always paid a fair wage, a very fair wage. And we did. I really learned a lot about my own style of management during the building of that house over those summers, because I wanted the men to have pride in what we were doing. And so I had them read the books about airships. And I said, when I ask you a question, I really need you to give me a real answer about what you think and not some baloney about, oh, yeah, we can do that. And I fed them a meal every day that they worked. And we had a party at the end so they could bring their family and their friends to share what they'd done. And they had a lot of pride over that period of time.
And you also made them pay a fine if they said any curse words or anything
sexist.
No,
not curse words. Oh, anything, I can out-curse them.
Yeah, anything sexist or racist.
Or bigoted. Right. And they had to put money in a jar.
So many of them were actually working in the red most of the time.
Well, we also had a jar that had topics. So when they started their racist topics, they had to pull something out of the jar, and usually the thing they pulled, which was the one they hated the most, was, am I a feminist?
Well, you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie, the feminist Warmke, reminding you, what are we reminding them, Annie?
That it's the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God. So we were just talking about the early days of building the airship, but the mechanics of building the airships, it was interesting and disheartening and difficult and hot and sweaty and the like.
But anything worthwhile is going to be like that.
Right. But what occurred to me is that the strange thing for me, or the strange reality that we ran into, was when we finally decided to do this. Okay, we're building an airship and we're going to leave our lives in what is the American dream and give up that part and then move to this home made out of tires in Appalachia. The process of divorcing from the previous life and moving into this one was difficult.
I think it was a lot more difficult for you. I tell people I've been walking to this place all my life And I believe that's true pretty much every day, except when I have the flu. So I think it was harder for you being a white educated guy who was supposed to always be achieving success and not even knowing for sure what that meant. And I believe that a lot of the things that happened in those days brought us to a very the heart of where we are today, and that is the values that we place on our relationship with each other and the people we love. And if that's all good, we can figure out the rest of it. And I don't think that's changed at all.
Yeah, I guess I was surprised that I knew it and I didn't know it, that there are a lot of judgments, expectations, both from ourselves and from our greater society, people looking at you, that you are supposed to be going down a certain path. You know, you're supposed to be moving towards accumulating more stuff, getting higher salaries, getting more recognition through your work. All of these things that are laid upon us as citizens of America. And if you step back and say, all right, I know this is the path I'm supposed to be going down, but I choose to reject that path and go over here, people were kind of freaking out about it.
Well, I mean, really, if you think about it, it wasn't really that we ever intended to live there except when we were old, and we certainly weren't old yet. But we made some pretty stark decisions after 9/11 and all the craziness that came from that. And so we really started to accelerate our letting go of everything that we had been taught as young people living in the U.S. And I mean, I think I had let go of it much sooner because of my work with battered women and women in prison and things like that. But I think we really stopped questioning and just said, we have to walk away. We have to walk away from all of these things that people seem to think are so dear. And it wasn't even that we were unhappy, because the reality was we were happy being together. So we were happy in the big vehicle driving around, flying everywhere, or we were happy sitting in a hut and where the trees could fall down on us in the storm. So that was the power of all of that. It's still the power. So I think, you know, the other thing maybe is valuable is that I know when I made the changes in myself, but I think you made the changes when you were at the ski lift that day when we were going to go hiking in Spain. And it just clicked in your brain that you could do something else.
Yeah, and I think we use the term of divorcing ourselves from our previous life. And that's probably a pretty good analogy, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, you really are. And there's a lot of heartbreak associated with that.
Yes, it was very painful.
Because you're giving up things. And of course, our life that we divorced from was a pleasant life. It was nice. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, everything's horrible and I need to go off to do something else. It was more a matter of this over here feels more appealing than this over here.
Well, it can sustain us.
Yeah. But yeah, they're both fine.
Well, I don't know if the other one could have sustained us or not.
I think we would have found, as we aged, I suspect there would have been a greater level of discontent.
Yeah,
that would have grown, especially once you begin to realize, you know, that this is not the path you want to be on. That's always dangerous when you remain on a path when you know that's not the right one.
Well, I have to say it was very painful for me. As far as letting go of our lives in Florida, because that's where my friends were, my work had been there. And so as much as I wanted to be where I am today, it was incredibly painful, and I was very depressed the beginning of the time we were living overseas, just in having to let go of all of it. And the dog. That was the worst, to have to give up the dog. So, but anyway, there are lots of good stories.
Well, you don't necessarily have to give up your dog if you want to move to a house in the country. That's a little.
No, I had to give up
the
dog.
We did it because we moved over to Europe for a couple of years.
That's right.
Now, we did have to give up the dog. How come we didn't give up the cats? I'm still wondering about that.
Because I said I'd given up everything, and I didn't want to give up the two cats. and you're being the saint and went along with it in spite of the fact that they became the two most expensive cats ever. Anyway, but one of the things I wanted to tell about is there's a lot of funny stories about building the house and also the ignorance of people in thinking about construction in a different kind of way. And so one of the things that happened was in the very beginning, I had decided I was going to educate the health department about composting toilets because I was very interested in the idea of having all of that material be available for growing food, because everything we've had to do there is to counter the clay soil so we could grow things.
And government bureaucrats love to be educated, right?
Well, I don't know. Maybe they do about certain things. But so every winter I would come to trim the fruit trees that I had planted in the summers. And then I would come from the plane to the health department with all the stuff I'd been mailing and try to have a conversation. So the last time I had done this, it was very cold out and I was sitting there waiting, and the guy in the health department was talking on the phone to somebody, and he said, "Ma'am, you know, unless there's poop going everywhere and the neighbors are screaming bloody murder, we don't have enough people to do anything about it." So I packed up my briefcase and I went home. And that was sort of the beginning of my intuitiveness about health department people. So I had applied for a permit to have a composting toilet, and they chose not to respond. We paid money to the state of Ohio. We wanted to have a special exception. So when we got ready to build the house, we decided we were going – we got some of the walls up, and we decided we were going to have an open house. And over 400 people showed up that day, and I was so excited because it told me I was on to something. And that was on Saturday. And on Monday, when we were starting to pound tires, we heard this very loud car coming down the lane. And when it came into view, it was a teeny tiny, in those days they called them Hugos.
Hugo.
So they were produced in Yugoslavia. And the man driving the vehicle was as big as the car. And the dog, Loretta, started to bark, and she barked right in his face because the car was very tiny, and she wouldn't stop barking. And I said to him, "I can't call her off." Now, that might not have been exactly the truth, but she wouldn't have heard anybody. So he started cranking up the window. And so through the window, he's yelling at me, "Do you have a stub for the septic tank?" And he showed me like a hand drawing of a 1950s style ranch-style house, and I started to correct him when he showed me where the stub was for the septic, and I thought, no, that's where it is. It's on the front of the house. And he said, "I'm in a lot of trouble if I don't show up with the right drawing today." And I said, "Well, that's right." And he left in his loud little Yugoslavian car, and we never saw him again. And the men could hardly believe it. They said, "You didn't let him get out of the car." I said, "No, the dog didn't let him get out of the car." Mm-hmm. And so that's pretty much how we dealt with things in those days, because we were doing a lot of strange things, but we weren't outside the law.
As far as they know, right?
Well, I had researched it, so I knew that I knew Ohio revised code backwards and forwards around those mm-hmm. things in those days.
And today, you know, in some ways, I think the regulations are a little more restrictive, and in many ways, they're less restrictive because green technologies, sustainable building techniques are becoming a little bit more mainstream in many parts of the country.
I think it's mostly the Amish who have outhouses and different things like that that's made it possible, if you only use a certain amount of water, to be able to have composting toilets in some areas. And we often get asked a lot about zoning and restrictions. And I just want to say that those are unique to each community, and that information is available through your township trustees or your local health department. And you have to check all those things and the state of Ohio, because if you do something they don't like, they can keep you from occupying the building.
Mm-hmm. So the building of the structure itself was sort of the first step for us, and probably the first step for most people when they decide to make these kind of changes. But I guess I'm a little more interested in just how sustainability becomes a bit of an all-consuming lifestyle option. So I mean, when we talk about sustainability, when we have tours and we say, all right, the house made out of garbage, that may be a draw, but sustainability is more about your behaviors than it is about where you are. So what are some of the sustainable practices that you feel sort of come to mind when you talk about making these changes and jumping into the deep end of the pool?
Well, I see it more as a lifestyle. So my life is one of being aware of what I use and how I use it and trying not to waste anything, composting anything that can rot so that I'm making soil. And it's also in how we eat, making choices about the foods that we eat and how we prepare those foods and how we eat them with other people, sharing what we have, sharing our resources. It's about my spiritual practices, how I take care of myself, my health. So it's all those kinds of things. And that's very different than how we got started, which was basically saying we want to build a house out of trash because we want to make a difference for people other than ourselves.
I think, you know, looking back all those years ago, gosh, how many years ago was it that we started this?
96. We started building the house 96.
But we started talking about it in 93?
93 or 94, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. And how naive, you know, because, again, it was really all about the structures at that point. Now it becomes more about the internal sustainability within our minds. It just reminded me when you're saying that, I have that sticker on my laptop from Cicero, the quote from Cicero that says, if you have a library and a garden, you have everything you need, you know? And I think to me, the journey has been going from this idea of you are what you do and you are what you have to more focusing on you are who you are, you know. It's that internal landscape that becomes much, much more important. And that's a constant struggle. It's a struggle for all of us. But I think being in a place like the Earthship where it's quieter, a little more relaxed, a little less focused on the external world helps me at least try and stay centered in that. And you're giving me this little like, oh,
I love
weed hopper.
No,
you are so.
I'm not. I'm not. I love my life. I cannot conceive of any other life that I have, even though people think I'm weird and all that. I don't really care. I have a rich life.
Well, the dogs love you. Well, you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. Thank you for spending just a little bit of time with us. And as your grandmother should have told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is?
Play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and eat your vegetables, Jay Warmke.
And build an Earthship.
Okay.
All right, till next time.
I will be revealed. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be healed. Come out, see the morning glory, blossom in the night. Know the skies dancing.
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.